on radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers, this is Invest Talk. Independent thinking, shared success. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. Here is KPP Financial Chief Executive Officer, Financial Advisor Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to Invest Talk. This is our Tuesday, July 15th, 2025 edition of Invest Talk, and we're halfway through the month of July, and just beginning earnings season. We had some reactions today. Certainly the market had a rougher day than it's had in a little while. Now, that could that pertain to the moves over the next couple of months, potentially? But we'll look at that and really answer your finance and investment questions. That's what this show is about. It's about what's on your mind. I want to help you take that next step in your own version of financial freedom. Everyone starts in a different place. Everyone's goal is a bit different, but the principles are the same. And we're here to give you that foundation, that mindset, so that you can see through the headlines, so that you can avoid the emotions of investing and really focus on the task at hand, which is making smart decisions. From a personal finance standpoint, as well as when you're investing, a risk-reward standpoint. Okay, so that's what this is all about here on Invest Talk. It's further educating you as our listener and helping you achieve your ultimate goal. Now, in just a bit, we'll talk about today's market performance and run down some show topics. But as usual, we'll tackle this caller question first.
Hi, can I have your opinion on buying this stock for a long-term investment, FPI? Thank you so much.
All right, looking at Farmland Partners. This is a REIT that owns high-quality cropland, farmland, with 132,000 acres in 15 states here in the United States. Now, 2.1% yield, so not a high yield compared to a lot of other REITs that are out there. So that's one thing to consider. But as you know, having a low or high yield is not the end of the story. It's just part of the story. Now let's look at the rest of the story. $513 million market cap with about $300 million in debt. So a good amount of debt. And free cash flow is pretty meager, only about $10 million in free cash flow. I don't love that. And its payout ratio is 111%. So what I'm seeing is a dividend that probably is not going to grow and is probably at risk of eventually being cut. In fact, if you go back to 2018, they were paying 12 cents, almost 13 cents a quarter. Now they're down to 6 cents, and they've been there really ever since 2023. And that debt level, I don't love. And if you look at funds from operation expectations for this year, so it's supposed to be up 3% and then another 3% next year, from 29 cents last year to 30 cents this year to 31 cents next year. On an $11.17 stock. That's pretty expensive. This is more of a land grab. It's a farmland grab. And that's what you are buying it for. Not because it's a great business. Not because it has a great balance sheet. Because frankly, neither are true. Doesn't have great cash flow. It's not trading at a particularly cheap price compared to earnings, funds from operations, cash flow, etc. But it is, if you're looking at a book value basis, it's trading a little over 1x book, which is on the cheap side. Now you have to dig into the details of that portfolio and see, you know, what is the true value. And that's very difficult to do in this sense, especially for the average person. So, you know, I look at the business, not amazing. I look at the technicals. I zoom out to a weekly chart, I see nothing exciting here either. So unless you just want exposure to land values, farmland values, I don't really see a compelling reason to buy this REIT over many others that are out there. I think this is very low on the list, unless you really want that specific focus of, I want to own farmland, a diversified amount of farmland. That's the only logical reason to own this REIT. Okay. Now, we have a lot of ground to cover over the next 45 minutes or so, and our main focus point is about good and bad debt. What is the difference between good debt and bad debt? And where are the gray areas? What are the factors to consider when you're thinking about taking on debt and whether it's likely a good path forward or not? In addition, we have other topics on the docket. One is in regards to the banks, and not really the big banks, the smaller banks, because the smaller banks tell you a lot more about the broader economy than those larger banks, especially in this environment, and we'll talk a little bit about why. Also, does America have Dutch disease? We'll talk about what that is and whether or not we have it. Then lastly, if we have time, a lot of people are being forced into retirement, maybe slightly before they would like to, right? Maybe in their late 50s, early 60s, maybe into their mid to late 60s, but not wanting to retire, but being pushed into it. And we'll talk about that as well if we have time. We also have voice bank questions. One is in regards to DoorDash, and the other is Opera, O-P-R-A. We also have some questions that came in via the comment section over on the Invest Talk YouTube channel as well. And of course, I welcome your finance and investment questions right now. So we're heading into a break. I welcome your questions. No question is too simple or too complex. You set the agenda. So give Invest Talk a call at 888-99-CHART.
Serious investors are certain to have finance and investment questions.
Wanted to get your take on W.W. Granger.
And the best person to ask your question in the right way is you.
And I was wondering, from your standpoint, is there a downside in buying fractional shares versus whole shares?
And 24/7, rain or shine, Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero stand ready to provide their unbiased answers.
The issue, though, is really over the last decade or so, it's never maintained this level of profitability for a long period of time.
Commodities are incredibly volatile, so when the going is good, take some profit.
Your participation makes InvestTalk better.
My name is Mike. I'm calling in from Orange County, California.
And this is Lewis calling from Bolivia.
Let's go talk to Chris in Maine.
So don't forget to call InvestTalk.
First off, great show. I've learned a lot from you too.
888-99-CHART. InvestTalk is here to help. And when you download the free InvestTalk podcasts, don't forget to rate and review. The phone lines are open, 888-99-CHART.
Now let's take a look at the market today for July 15th, 2025. Overall, it was a negative day. We closed near the lows on the day. And you still had the NASDAQ eking out a gain slightly of about 37 points, about 18 basis points there, so 0.18%. But the S&P fell 40 basis points. The Dow was down about 1%. And really, it was the value side of the market that continued to struggle over the last couple of days. And it was really around the banks. So if I look at a heat map here, you had some pretty sizable moves. Wells Fargo down over 5%, BlackRock down almost 6%, American Express down 3%, but I think BlackRock and Wells Fargo, I believe they both had earnings there. But it wasn't just the banks. You also had names like Tesla down 2%. You had Eli Lilly and AbbVie, some of the bigger pharma names. Those were down pretty sizably. Merck was down sizably. You had Pfizer down sizably. So a lot of United Health continued to bleed. And the really The only thing that was holding up the market was NVIDIA, up 4% on the day. Broadcom up 2% on the day. AMD also stronger. Oracle a bit stronger. Microsoft up a little bit. And that was kind of it. Everything else was red. We closed near the lows of the day. And it felt like certainly at least a potential for a near-term top. Now, that doesn't mean you have to, it doesn't mean that one day is not a trend. You would need a follow-through. Once again, we're getting into earnings season, and that's going to be an important dynamic to see how the market reacts. And so far, the market has not reacted positively. Now, we did have June CPI. That rose 0.2% month over month on the core side, but which was a bit lower than expected. Now, the year over year was about in line on the core side of what was expected. But if you look at headline CPI, that was up 0.3% month over month and a bit ahead of expectations. Expectations were for it to come in year over year at about 2.5. It came in at about 2.7% year over year. Shelter inflation did rise 0.2% month over month, and that drove most of the overall increase. Okay, you did see deceleration in things like hotels, used vehicles were down, new vehicles were down, airfares were down a little bit. So kind of a mixed bag, shall we say. So on the inflation front, not a death knell or anything like that, but certainly a bit higher than expected. And the odds of a Fed rate cut in September actually fell a little bit. And so you saw the dollar rallying. You also saw interest rates rise, especially on the back end of the curve. Okay. So you saw the 30-year up 4 basis points, moving back above that all-important 5% level. And the 2-year yield was up 5 basis points. So once again, kind of pricing in a bit more hawkish of a Fed over the next couple of years. Bitcoin was down 2.9. So we had that breakout above 20,000, but we have fallen considerably below that level now. So so far it's been kind of a false breakout. We'll see once again, do we get follow through overnight and into tomorrow? The dollar was up 0.6%. WTI crude was down 0.7% on the day. And gold finished down 0.7%. So, I've said this as we get closer to OPEX, we are in OPEX week, as we get into earnings season there and in closer to August and September, the market likely will at least at the bare minimum chop sideways and could bring you a decent correction due to seasonality, due to OPEX, gamma squeeze unwinds, things like that. There's some market dynamics there that matter. But ultimately, that's what you saw today. Some weakness, especially into the close. And we'll see if we get more follow through tomorrow as we see more earnings announcements. Now, every day we receive questions from the comment section of the Invest Talk YouTube channel. And let's answer one of those questions now. Luke says, hello, Invest Talk. I would like to get thoughts on CAL or Caleres. They had a terrible year-long losing 50% of its market value and was thinking it might be an attractive time to buy or at least keep an eye on. The company's book value is worth more than the stock price and has a 6 PE. They also have paid a dividend for 55 years straight. Is this a value stock or am I missing something? Interesting. Let's go dig into Caleres, C-A-L is the symbol here. And interesting, bringing up the book value of the company. Now, let's take a look at its leverage. Anytime a company falls 50% like this, it did peak out around $44 per share. Now we're down to $13 per share. So 44 was not that long ago either. And yeah, that's the big question here. Is the debt. $258 million in long-term debt on a $452 million market cap, and free cash flow has now turned into basically zero. Free cash flow back in the third quarter of 2023 peaked out at $180 million. Well, now it's at just $325,000. So less than $1 million trailing 12 months. Okay. And last quarter, you had free cash flow at negative $26 million. So we've dipped down into negative territory. Earnings are expected to fall 31% this year. Dividend is 2%. But unless they are able to recapture their cash flow, that a dividend is likely to be eliminated at some point. They just don't have the cash flow for it right now. So, you know, I think while you are looking at a company from a book value perspective that is cheap, that debt is hanging over it. And until I get clarity on that cash flow, I'm passing on it. And certainly the chart remains challenged as well. So I would continue to watch it, but I would not be buying it right now. Now we're moving to a break, still to come. My main focus point and more answers to your questions. So give me a call now at 888-99-SHARP.
Have you heard about the new InvestTalk store? That's right, you'll find great merch for the savvy investor. It's all there for you now at InvestTalkStore.com. And now Justin Klein is here and taking your finance and investment questions live. Call InvestTalk 888-99-CHART.
Our main focus point on InvestTalk today is about good debt and bad debt. Now, there are some people, like my grandfather, who he would say that all debt, was bad debt. But others take a more nuanced approach, and I am one of those. Good or bad debt depends on what you're spending it on and the terms at which you borrow. Generally, good debt allows someone to accomplish something, whether that is meaningful personal goals or it is to add personal capital, mainly education, so that they can grow their value in the marketplace and grow their income. So let's talk about what is considered good debt and bad debt. And a lot of times it isn't black or white. In this world of right versus left, you know, political polarization, I always like to say the world does not exist in extremes. The vast majority of things, political, non-political, financial, non-financial, there's usually an in-between that is closer to reality than one side is right or one side is not. And that same thing with good and bad. So most people think of good debt. Start with good debt, and I'll tell you when it can be good and when it can creep into bad. The first is mortgages. Most people will consider a mortgage on your home to be good debt because it's helping you accomplish some personal goals, lifestyle goals, okay, for example. It allows you to be an owner and maybe change the home in ways that more fits your lifestyle and your needs. And it helps you build equity over time. But it can be bad if you are taking on too much mortgage debt at too high of the interest rate, paying things like PMI, or buying a quote-unquote investment property, and your cash flow is deeply negative. So there's ways that mortgages can be bad for your financial health. But it does tend to be one if you're using it in the simple way most do, which is 30-year fix, try to keep that rate low, maybe pay a bit more on it over time. But it can be good debt for a lot of people. Number two, student loans. For most people, younger, they're trying to further their education, and they know what they want to do. It can be great debt to take on because that cost will be amortized over decades of work, and the payback period is often very short. But that's only if you kind of know what you're doing. or what you want to do, what your career path is. I remember back when I was in college, there were plenty of kids. I was lucky enough to know going into college what I wanted to do. But there were plenty of kids that, you know, were just there to be there, to enjoy college and quote unquote, figure it out. Now, I was lucky to go to college, you know, over a couple decades ago. And, you know, it felt expensive at the time, but it's way more expensive than it is today. Sorry, way more expensive today than it was then. So you have to really know what you're going to do. If you're just kind of floating, trying to figure it out, oftentimes student debt can become very bad. Because a lot of those kids drop out, but they still have that debt, but they don't have the degree or knowledge to really advance their careers. So it can turn into bad debt. Business loans. This can be good debt if you, once again, you have a business plan, you know how to execute it, you have some experience, but just taking out loans to start a business without really a clear direction and a clear understanding of how to make it in the marketplace, it can turn into bad debt very quickly. Then interest-free loans. Interest-free loans, once again, can be good if you are making energy efficient improvements to your home, for example, and getting 0% loans for that. And there are programs for that. You might be getting down payment assistance programs, for example. So there are ways to do this, but the bad debt turns into bad debt when it's some sort of like a buy now, pay later. It's a gimmick, right? You get 0% for X number of months or years, and it's interest free. But if you don't pay it all off by the end of that period, you accrue interest throughout that time, and then you are charged it at the end of that period. So you have to make sure that interest free loans are truly interest free, or if they are on some sort of payment plan, that you make sure you pay that off by the end of the period. If you can't, then it can turn into very, very expensive and bad debt rather quickly. And that goes the same with refinancing debt. So a lot of times you'll get these offers in the mail to consolidate your credit card loans and you know, refinance what you are currently paying on. And that can be a good way to lower your overall interest rate. But if you instead use that out to go up your spending more, it can turn into bad debt. Okay, so it's really about how you use the debt and make sure you limit it. You limit the interest rate and you use it for specific purposes as opposed to just discretionary fun. You definitely don't want to add debt for those reasons. Now we're heading into a break, but I'm ready to take your questions now on InvestTalk 888-99-CHART. No matter what our day looks like, I think we can agree that we all need nourishment that fuels us, right? So let me tell you about Kachava's Whole Body Meal Shakes. I'm really liking them. And bonus surprise, the Kachava Shakes come in 5 delicious flavors. Chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, coconut acai. Variety is a good thing. And it's easy to incorporate Kachava's Whole Body Meal Shakes into my daily routine. I like to personalize my Kachava by adding nice touches like frozen blueberries, almond milk, creatine. For me, the idea is to mix it up while keeping my body and mind nourished all day. In fact, Kachava is a whole body meal with plant-based protein that actually tastes delicious. In those 5 indulgent flavors I mentioned, you get 25 grams of 100% plant-based protein with every 2 scoops of Kachava. You get 85 plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Kachava is non-GMO. There are no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. There's no soy, no animal products, no gluten, and no preservatives. You can even try Kachava risk-free with their Love It guarantee. Fuel your day with Kachava. Go to kachava.com and use code INVEST for 15% off on their subscription for a limited time. That's Kachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A. .com, code INVEST for 15% off.
The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. So don't forget to call InvestTalk 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Hi, Justin. I'm actually a longtime listener of your Index Talk podcast. First of all, I'd like to get your thoughts on ticker symbol DASH. Looking at DoorDash, which has been a high flyer as of late, when you look at the earnings, you know, the various stats on the air, what tool are you using to investigate the companies that come across your line? You know, I look at Dash and I see the PE ratio is like 304, which seems astronomic to me. Why is there such hype about this stock? Why would anybody buy a stock with a PE ratio of 304? I guess that's my question. Thanks a lot.
Well, if you ever pop over to our YouTube channel, I do share my screen so you can see what I'm using and the data. And I use multiple sources. So one is Market Surge. It's by Investor's Business Daily. That's just a good, clean view of kind of the trends in earnings, both going forward for them this year and next year, as well as over the past 8 quarters and the future 4 quarters. Also gets a chart, profitability, PE ratio, like you said, dividend, all of that. So that's nice. I also use a thing called Y charts. I also use something called FactSet. So we have multiple tools to get data. A lot of it that is overlapping, but for the show, you know, we quickly are able, or I'm quickly able to see what's happening with the business with some of these tools. So that's what I'm using. But obviously, when we're doing deeper dives with for our clients, you know, digging into not just the data, but qualitative reports like Morningstar and other reports about leadership and the industry, et cetera. So there's deeper data that we're looking at. But when I'm on air, I'm kind of giving an overview here. So DoorDash, about $95 billion market cap. And you're correct. It is at a pretty high P ratio. Now, forward looking, if you look at earnings for this year, next year, 219 this year, 366 next year, it's not quite as egregious. It's still very high. You are correct. But you're talking about a forward looking P multiple of 75. That's still very, very high. So you're right. It is still expensive. Price to sales ratio is 9.3. That's very high. And frankly, I do think that while DoorDash has a good business, at least right now, I think it's going to be highly cyclical. So I would not be buying at these levels. The market's pricing in a lot of great growth, a lot of cash flow creation over the coming years, which frankly has taken off. It was kind of neutral free cash flow for a while, kind of hanging between zero and about $300 million through 2020, 2021. And now it's at $1.8 billion. So it's had a nice leg higher over the last couple of years. But once again, I'm not buying into that level of a multiple after this move. I think there'll be a down cycle that you could buy into, but it has to come in dramatically, like you said. And for right now, I would pass on DoorDash. Now let's play another fresh caller question at 888.
Hi, Justin and Luke. I'm calling today about Opera, ticker OPRA. I've held it for about a year and a half now, and I am up on it. I was wondering if you think it's time to take some profits or if I should hold on and continue letting it grow. Thank you very much. It's just a small portion of our portfolio. Have a good day. Bye.
All right. Looking at Opera, OPRA, and this is a name that we actually own for our covered call strategy, equity income. And it's actually one of our, from a size perspective, it's probably our smallest company in that strategy, about $1.6 billion market cap, 4% dividend yield, but good, consistent growth, great cash flow, as well as market or debt levels, a balance sheet. No long-term debt, $78 million in free cash flow on an enterprise value of $1.5 billion. So you're talking about a 5% free cash flow yield, and it's growing its earnings significantly. Last year, earnings grew 27%. Not only supposed to be 4% growth this year, but 30% growth next year. And it is solidly profitable. 9% return equity, not amazing, but solid. And once again, it's about that cash flow and good balance sheet. And they're using that cash flow to buy back shares, pay that dividend, which they certainly can pay at this point, with once again with that balance sheet and that cash flow. And revenue growth is solid. Last quarter, revenue grew 40%. Quarter before that, revenue grew 29%. This quarter, revenue is supposed to grow 25%. So we like it. We like the business. For everyone else out there, they have a web browser for mobile phones and your desktop. And they cater to the gaming industry. So it's a browser that if you browse through, you game through a browser, it is very fast for those applications. It also has a built-in VPN. So if you want to use a VPN and you don't want to have kind of this third-party thing, it's kind of built into the browser there. There are some cryptocurrency features, crypto wallets that are built in to the browser. So there's a lot of great features. It's kind of a niche player, to be frank, but that's why it's small. But we think there's a lot of runway for the business. So I would continue to hold Opera. We continue to hold it. Thanks for the call. Now let's look at the banks. And we are in the midst of earnings season now, and we're going to get more and more bank earnings, especially throughout this week. But a lot of people might look at the big banks and they say, okay, what are they doing? Are things improving for them? What does that mean for the overall economy? And if you look at the performance of the banks, especially in the second quarter, they did very, very well. 14%, the KBW Bank Index. But that was mainly driven by the mega banks. Goldman Sachs, for example, was up almost 30% on the quarter. But if you look at the regional banking index, that was only up 3% in the second quarter. And so what does that tell you? Well, it tells you that there's two different drivers of the performance, and it's not really the broader economy. Those larger banks are outperforming for a couple of main reasons. Number one is that M&A activity has started to reaccelerate, and many of those large banks have an investment banking arm. And so the market is seeing that, and the fees that they're going to earn from helping with those M&As. And then you have an easing of capital requirements. And this especially helps those businesses, those large banks, because think of SIFI, strategically important financial institutions. So they had, post-financial crisis, an additional charge in their capital to make sure that they were safe. Remember, because you know, if you have a Silicon Valley bank go under, some small regional bank, that's not a big problem to the financial system. But what 08 taught the regulators was that if you have a JP Morgan or a Bank of America or a Wells Fargo, one of the large banks going under, that is strategically important. And therefore, they need a bigger capital buffer. Well, what's happening now under the Trump administration is that they're starting to ease those requirements, and that's going to help those larger banks, at least in the short term, with lending activity and being able to squeeze more profits out of their business. So those are the reasons why those larger banks did well. But underneath the surface, like I said, those small regional banks, they're not doing nearly as well. Their fortunes track the economy more directly, mainly because they're domestically focused. Those larger banks also don't, they have foreign operations, and that can help them or hurt them. But once again, those smaller banks, they're regional. They're regional here in the U.S., and they have very little exposure to what happens overseas. Now, recently, commercial industrial loan activity, which is typically the center of what these small and mid-sized banks tend to do, that's actually increased. It's picked up. Not dramatically, about 3% year-over-year growth. Decent, but not amazing. You know, better than it was earlier in the year. Coming into the year, at the end of January, year-over-year growth was only 1.1%. So we're up to 3%. So that's a positive. But the big question is, why are companies taking out these loans? Because these are commercial and industrial loans. And the answer is simply they're loading up on inventory. So it's not like they're taking out these loans to hire a bunch of people to spend on CapEx, to expand their operations or anything like that. It's really just to front run tariffs. So companies are playing defense, not exactly offense. And that is probably the biggest takeaway here, and why the movement in banks is not really telling you to be rosy on the overall economy. So remember, the financial markets are not the economy, and vice versa. You know, 2022 is a good example. S&P was down 20%. NASDAQ was down 33%. But we didn't go into recession. It was a bear market, but we didn't really go into a real recession. There wasn't a big change in unemployment, a blowout in credit spreads. It was just the markets re-rating, liquidity being drained from the system, and margins contracting, multiples contracting, excuse me. And so that's a good example there. And this last few months is another good example the other way, that, you know, the economy, especially in May and into June, started to show real weakness, even if the capital markets continued to show strength. And a big reason for that strength was this, where companies are not using that money to hire, they're using that money to front run tariffs, and they are buying back their stock in absence of clarity around how they should spend that money. And so never confuse the equity markets, the bond markets, with the broader economy and vice versa. And you want to focus a lot on those smaller banks. Let's go with another listener question via the YouTube comment section. Carlo Pooner says, I'm based in Europe and I hold Vanek Uranium and Nuclear Technologies ETF, NUCL. Let's see if I can look this up. I might need my other system. Yes. Okay. So, you know, just a heads up, when you are overseas, an investor, it can be a challenge to invest in U.S. markets. And there are these kind of special investment vehicles that you don't really get a whole lot of data here in America. They're not your typical ETFs. So this one may be a challenge. Let me look the other one up. So he said he wants to increase his position in nuclear as a general principle. Should I diversify or try another fund as well, or should I buy more NUCL? Looking at the Global X Uranium, URA is the symbol. Now that is something that does trade on our exchange, URA, I know that. Global X Uranium ETF. The issue with this is, once again, it's just uranium miners. I think we talked about this recently. Let me look at this. Actually, no, there are some industrials. 25% are industrials. You have Oklo, which is a small modular reactor company. So you are getting some exposure there. NextGen Energy, I really need to look at the holdings of NUCL, which I don't really have. Let me see. I'm not really getting any data on this. Research. Here we go. Holding summary. Let's see if I can get some holdings here. No, my FactSet's not giving me any holdings either. That's interesting. Yeah, see, this is the challenge, is just getting more data on those other names. So I don't mind URA. I would want something that holds a more diversified set of companies. If the NUCL, the Nuclear Technologies ETF that you can access over there, it has a more industrial focus, I would rather own that. Once again, the URA does have some, but I know there are other ones out there that give you better diversification across the sector, but still exposure to the nuclear space. So I like that you are going after that, but I would probably want something with more industrial exposure. Now let's squeeze in a quick question from 888-99-CHART.
Hi, I'm calling about stock Casey's General Stores, ticker CASY. I'd like to know what you think about this company and if it's a good buy or sell. Thanks.
All right, looking at Casey's General Store, and this operates about 2,600 convenience stores in 20 states under the Casey's General Store brand name. $19 billion market cap, and this is one of those high-quality businesses. Now, the issue in today's market is that a lot of quote-unquote quality businesses are trading at pretty high prices. And this is one that certainly is not cheap. Enterprise value to EBITDA around 18 times, okay, which is the highest it's ever traded on that type of multiple. Earnings this year is supposed to go up 8%, 13% next year is $17.84, and it's a $517 stock. Nice little dividend there. And the technicals are fine. But I think you missed the boat here. It's trading at, to me, too high of a valuation for the growth that it has. I would absolutely keep it on my watch list. This will probably break at some point, and you'll have a significant pullback where the multiples contract back in probably the mid to low 20s, and that's where I would buy it, but not right now. Now we're heading into our final break. I'm ready for your calls now at 888-99-CHART.
. 2025 rolls on, and you've got finance and investment questions for Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero. Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
What is Dutch disease? Let's talk a little bit about that. And this is a term that refers to what happened to the Dutch starting in the mid-60s into the mid-70s. Now, in the late 1960s, the Dutch economy drastically changed. Why? Because in 1964, the country found natural gas deposits in the North Sea. And by 1974, the country was exporting about 74 million tons of oil per year. Equivalent, okay, from zero, exporting no gas before that. Now, what did the country do? Well, it started to take the taxes due to this windfall and increase social spending. And it increased the value of the Dutch currency, and manufacturing outside of the oil sector fell. Cost went up domestically. Exchange rates made those exports harder. And by 1975, the output of the clothing industry in the Netherlands had dropped 15%. And footwear dropped more than 50%. And so what it refers to is this, what looks like an advantage turning into a disadvantage due to a stronger currency. And many think that the entire world, including the United States, has Dutch disease. Now, the United States is the most obvious because we export a lot of dollars. In order to export those dollars, we have to take on debt. It's kind of how the system has evolved. And the strong dollar, due to money just pouring in, especially to our equity markets, to our debt markets, has caused the dollar to rise and make our exports less competitive. So if you want to bring manufacturing back to the U.S., you need the dollar to fall. You need to cleanse us of our Dutch disease. Now, in the 1990s, a UCLA economist began to document countries that fell victim to this. And they looked at how that windfall made the country either stronger or weaker. And it looked at a couple things. One is whether the institutions were strong and whether there was social solidarity. If the institutions were strong, the windfall will be go to the people. It will go to those that need it. And it would go to parts of the economy that were making the country better. Investing in schools and roads and infrastructure. But if the institutions were weak, money would then flow to powerful groups and into unproductive endeavors. So the big question you have to ask yourself, are the U.S. institutions strong or are they weak? Is there good social solidarity? Or are those that are closest to power purposely dividing the country so that they can take advantage of the windfall that is the dollar being the global reserve currency, right? Allowing the budget to continue to rise or the deficit to continue to rise in order for them to continue to garner all the profits. I think the answer is pretty simple. And that's where we are. So in order to reverse that, not only will you need a weaker dollar, but you need stronger institutions to counter the Dutch disease. Well, that about does it. I'm Justin Klein. This completes another Invest Talk program. And if today's show made you think about your own financial picture in any way, investments, investment strategy, taxes, asset allocation, retirement planning, whatever is on your mind, I encourage you to head over to investtalk.com, click on the portfolio review button, and schedule a call with myself or Luke. And we thank you. Thank you for listening. We encourage you to tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads, which you can find anytime at iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Be sure to rate and review on iTunes as well. Independent thinking, shared success. This is InvestTalk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461.